Very much, and I hope once again that our Dibrei Torah should be le'ilui neshama of your mother Sarah Bat Beatrice, and also Mordechai Abba Mendel. You know, it's very interesting. We're in, of course, the period of the Churban Beis Hamikdash, and the big question that everybody asks is, how do we mourn for the Churban Beis Hamikdash? We never saw the Beis Hamikdash, we never experienced the Beis Hamikdash. How can you describe color to a person who was born blind? How can you describe music to a person who was born deaf? It could very well be the generation that experienced the Churban, so they knew what they lost. When you know what you lost, you can feel tsar, but if you simply don't know, what is it that you can mourn over? Some answer, you mourn over the fact that you don't know what to mourn over. They actually tell a very famous story, a true story, that in 1967, when the Kotel was liberated, and Jews were able to go to the Harabayat, and not the Harabayat, but the Kotel, and pray. So there were religious chayalim who came to the Kotel, and they were crying in tears of joy that finally they're able to come as close as they could to the Makom HaMikdash. And there was a Chilani soldier who was not involved in Shabbat or Kashrut or anything, and he was crying as well. So one of his friends asked him somewhat mockingly, "What are you crying about?" And his response was, "I'm crying because I don't know what they're crying about." And in many, many ways, what this Chilani soldier said is exactly what we go through. We cry because we don't know what it is. Even we're so far from the Kedusha of the Beis HaMikdash. You know, people said, somebody described, I just read a description, that the first Tisha B'Av after 1967, when there was such a spirit, maybe some of you might have been here, I was not here then, I was just a little boy, he wasn't even born then, they described the first Tisha B'Av in a show after the 1967 war, and the Kehila started saying kinos, and they just stopped in the middle. They said, what are we saying? And you know, the visitor was very upset at this, you know, it's still Tisha B'Av. And people sometimes had the illusion that Baruch Hashem, you know, we live in Eretz Yisrael, we have a state of Israel, we're in Yerushalayim, and in the prayer of Nachem, we're going to talk about how the city is burnt and ruined, when in fact we look around and we see so many things. But in truth, if one understands that this is not only a physical description, but this is the spiritual distancing from God, we're very much far away. And of course, let me point out, even in a physical sense, we are not out of the hot water. When we talk about the treaties that the U.S. is going to have with Iran, you know, even in our minimal physical security, we're in a very precarious place. But ultimately, Tisha B'Av is about mourning the distance from Hashem that we had to drink.
I just have to say, I was here in 1967. I'm here since 1960 in Israel. And I was here in 67 after the war and the euphoria that took place on that first Tisha B'Av. And I remember I got all dressed up and I came to my parents' house and my father said to me, "Where do you think you're going today?" And I said, "Mashiach is coming today."
Yeah.
I mean, we were so sure,
yeah, people
that
were sure.
This was it.
Yep, that's right.
That
describes the mood, but you know, like Shira Shirim says, when Hashem is ready to redeem us, we're like the woman who's gone to sleep, right? Kol dodi dofek. The voice of my beloved is knocking at the door. And the woman says, "Sorry, I've gone to bed already. Come back later." And when the woman realizes that he's not going to be knocking again right now, she gets up and looks for him. And Shira Shirim is portraying the idea that somehow we haven't gotten our act together yet. And there is this idea where Hashem wants to, and when we're ready, Hashem says it's not the time. And after the Six-Day War came the Yom Kippur War, you know, and this balance of constantly seeing that our Geul is not perfect. But one mahalach that Mefarshim tell us is how we experience Galus and Geula, is by taking the personal experiences in our lives. A person has suffering, a person has bereavement, and a person feels the pain of loss. And then try to imagine to yourself the loss of a parent, the loss of a child, God forbid, the loss of a spouse. How devastating it is, how lonely it is. And then magnify it by 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times. And then you understand the Churban Beis HaMikdash. We have to start from our personal experience because that is the life that we have. And from our personal experience, we can extrapolate to the national calamities of Am Yisrael. This is why it's fascinating that one of the keynotes, and it always bothered me because it almost made no sense, one of the keynotes is about a story involving two people, a brother and a sister, who were from the Kohen, children of the Kohen Gadol, that they were taken as slaves and they were sold, and they wound up, one person owned the boy, one person owned the girl, and he said, the owner said, let's mate them and produce beautiful children that we can divide. And the son and the daughter were put in a room in total darkness, and they were told to have relations to produce children. And they didn't know that they were brother and sister, and each one just stood in the corner and refused. And in the morning, when they realized that they were brother and sister, and they realized the degradation and the shame that they were going through, they hugged, they embraced, and they died in their grief. It's a story, it's a sad story, but it's only two people. Like, why are we taking up our precious time on Tisha B'Av, which is the story of the calamities of Am Yisrael, and we focus on a story of two people?
Kohen Gadol,
the height, yeah, okay, it could be. But I would suggest that maybe the answer also is that we can't really comprehend numbers. We talk about 6 million people dying in the Holocaust. What's 6 million people? We gotta zoom in on the one child, the one person, that we can feel, that we can identify. And then I can do the multiplication in my head. This was one person. So many. So the same thing in our own experience of the Churban, we start with our personal tragedies in life. But at the same time, that's how we're margish geula, because in every life, there are also happy moments. The child gets married, you have grandchildren, there's recovery from illness. A person feels simcha, making aliyah, coming to Eretz Yisrael. A person feels simcha. And then you can multiply the simcha and understand what redemption is. So in a sense, part of how we experience mourning and how we experience redemption is we have to personalize it by focusing on the things that we've gone through in our own lives. And then we understand Churban, we understand Geula. Right? So we do have to start with our own lives in that way. And so again, I have to say, without embarrassing, I found what Joan said, and Cecil said, to be very, very meaningful. Because I think in some ways it represents a journey that not everybody goes through, but many people do go through. And that is, you know, you come from a place that was not so intensely religious as Yerushalayim is. And we come from, you know, backgrounds that to some degree we can say we've grown out of, we've moved away from, we've progressed in our Judaism because we've become more religious and our children are in Kollel and our whatever it would be. But we have to realize that in the process of the moving away, it is really because we're standing on the shoulders of those who came before us. And without that foundation, whatever we were able to accomplish, like it's the mashal that is given, that the midget on the shoulders of the giant can see farther than the giant, even though they're a midget, only because they're standing on the shoulders of the giant. You know, if you go back to the United States, even among people who were totally Shomer Shabbos, you know, 50, 60, 70 years ago, there were virtually no yeshivas. And, you know, an Orthodox Jew meant somebody who kept Shabbos, kept kosher. And many, many Jews were not able to keep Shabbos or kosher, even if they were tried to from. That the origin of early Shabbos minyanim on Shabbos, which are now the favorite of the yeshivasha crowd, were really put there so that, you know, people could daven and then go to work on Shabbos. So what happened was, and I've seen this in my own life, what happened is that sometimes as the new generation got more sophisticated, more knowledgeable, more learned, they sometimes looked down at the simpler balabatim, who didn't go to yeshiva, who were not so sophisticated, who didn't know all of the details of Hilchos Shabbos and the like. Even the rabbis they looked down upon. There are these modern rabbis, you know, what do they know compared to our Rosh Hashivas? But in fact, one has to know that all of the great progress, to the degree there is progress, there's so much more to do, but that there was progress in the growth of Torah, it really came on the backs of people who were, you know, simple, balabatim, people who tried to keep Torah and mitzvahs when it was very, very difficult. So the truth of the matter is that as we journey away from something, we also have to know that we have to reconnect to it as well, because it is very much the source of where we're from. And that really comes out in a very interesting lashon of the Parsha. When the Parsha enumerates the journeys of Bnei Yisrael, so it first says, "Vayichtav Moshe es motzaehem lemasehem." Now a motza is the place from which you leave. That you leave one place, and masa is where you're going to. So motza is the place of departure. Masa is the place of destination. So first it says, motzaehem lemasehem. Their departures towards their destination. That's exactly how you travel. But then it says, Ela Masehem Le Motsoehem. These are the departures or the destinations Le Motsoehem towards their departures. Now I understand, a departure takes you towards a destination. But a destination does not take you towards your departure. So how can you say, Masehem, their destinations, live, Motsehem, towards their point of origin? And part of it is that indeed, sometimes the further and further and further we progress from our point of departure, the more we have to reconnect to that point, knowing that that is the source of all of our Hatzlacha. And this all ties into the 3 weeks, because the Sifrei Kabbalah tell us that the 42 journeys in Parshas Masai represent the journey of the soul from Shemayim into this earth. And in many, many ways, our journey in life seems to be taking us away from Hashem. In Shemayim, we were with Hashem, and we're now put in a physical world of struggle. And we are leaving our place of origin, which is the Kisei Yakavod, and we are journeying to different destinations. But in reality, every step we are making away from Hashem is like a circle. When you have a circle, the further away you go from a point on one side of the circle, the closer you are on the other side. And therefore, the journey of a person's physical life, right, count, I'm further and further and further from Shemayim, right? I was closer to God and now I'm further and further and further. But in reality, the further I get, the closer I become. This is the message of the 3 weeks, the 9 days, Tisha B'Av. There are times of year that we feel closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And there are times of year that we feel distance from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But as this is the time of distance, this is the time of richuk, this is the time of feeling how far we are from the Almighty. But, as the saying goes in English, absence makes the heart grow fonder. As we feel how far we are, there wells up in our heart such a desire to be close to Hashem, that the sense of distance, going away from our origin, brings us closer to our origin. What starts off as a journey away from God becomes a journey towards our Shorish, towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Maharal says, this is the meaning of the well-known statement in Chazal, that Mashiach is born on Tisha B'Av. Now the Maharal says, it really is not important what day is Mashiach's birthday. L'may nafkamina. But what it really means is, the koach of redemption that comes into the world. Now there's the messianic power, is born by the yearning that Klal Yisrael has for the Geula in the depth of their mourning of Tisha B'Av. The deeper you mourn, the more you bring the koach of Mashiach into the world. So Mashiach does not mean, the birth of Mashiach does not mean the birthday of a human being, but the spiritual power of redemption that comes into the world. You know, it's very, very interesting. When we have brachos, we take them for granted. It's the absence that makes us yearn. In fact, Rav Putner once said, he was a great Gadol B'Torah, but also a very, very profound, incisive thinker. Rav Putner was really quite, even among the Gadolim, Rav Putner was quite unusual. So when Rav Putner spent his last years in Eretz Yisrael, remember he was actually hijacked, he was on a plane, but he spent his last years here, he was once asked, did he miss anything about Chutz La'aretz? I don't know why somebody asked him that. He says, yeah. He misses the yearning he had to come to Eretz Yisrael. Because, and again, I have to say, sometimes I hear an Ar Sameach, you know, we often have visiting Rabbanim coming from New York or Baltimore, and they address the issue and they talk about how much they pine and yearn to be in Eretz Yisrael. Oh, if only I can learn. What can I say? You know, you're jaded once you're here. I'm not bothered with the kotel today. I got laundry to do, or whatever it would be. So one can be bored, chas v'shalom, even in the middle of kedusha. One takes it for granted. And what Chorban can teach us, what absence can teach us, is not to take it for granted. And paradoxically, therefore, it is the awareness of Chorban that brings you closer to Hashem than even when everything is in place. Now I remember years ago, for some reason this line stuck because it was so incongruous, Feldheim published a novel about Rabbi Akiva's wife. Maybe some of you may have read it, and Rachel was her name. So for some reason, I read it many, many years ago, and I just remember this line where a bunch of teenage girls, it's a bit of an anachronism, they were saying, maybe let's go to the Beis HaMikdash today and watch the Korbanos, because you could do that, you know, you could watch. And they said, nah, it's the same thing every day there, you know, let's just go to the malls. I don't know if they had malls in those days. They said, let's go to the mall. Let's go shot the cargo, right? Let's go to the cargo, whatever. You know, so they say, yeah, they submit the same thing every day, the carbon coming, you know, nothing much to see there. You know, so you can take, the truth is, we can take everything for granted. And 3 weeks, this is the zman of feeling chisaron. When you feel chisaron, so that gives you closeness and love to Hashem. In fact, that's why the Rambam says, that based on the Gemara, that the place where the Baal Shuva stands is greater than the level of the tzaddik who never sins. Because the Baal Tshuva knows what it's like to be far from Hashem. Because he was far from Hashem. And now he has something. So he or she treasures it so much. Because they know what it was like without it. If a person was born always having Torah and mitzvahs, so they take it for granted. They take it for granted. And therefore the closeness to Hashem may not always be as great. One has to work on it. I'm not saying Hashem doesn't discriminate against tzaddikim either, but it means that a tzaddik may have to work on feeling a sense of closeness that a Baal Tshuva may have to work less on, because the Baal Tshuva knows what it's like. Same thing with everything. This is the way life is. Health. A person appreciates health very, very much when there is sickness and there's leisure to recover from it. When everything goes well, take it for granted, right? That's why in Judaism we have brachos. We make brachos on every little thing, a glass of water, I'm going to the bathroom, to try to teach us not to take things for granted. Because that is the human condition. We just take everything for granted all the time, when everything is a bracha. So one has to look as if every single time you breathe is a new gift from Hashem. It's a gift because it didn't have to happen. The fact that it happened, you know, a minute ago doesn't mean it has to happen now. Right? Every minute is a gift. And that's how a yid has to go through life. So there's a famous statement in the Gemara. The Gemara, I'm sure you've heard this many times. Kol ha-misabel al Yerushalayim zoche v'raya b'simchasa. Anyone who mourns over Jerusalem, zoche, so we always translate it as will merit and will see the joy. But I hope you can see that that is actually not a literal translation. Zoche v'raya is not future. Zoche v'raya is present, it's hoven. It should have said, Kol ha-misabel al Yerushalayim yizkeh v'yireh b'simchasa. He will merit and see its joy. Zocheh means while he is mourning, he is merits to see the joy. What does that mean? How do I merit to see the joy in the middle of my mourning? How could it be zocheh v'raya? So there's a famous vort from the Chassam Sofer. Very beautiful vort. Do you remember that when Yosef was sold by the brothers, and the brothers made up a story that Yosef was attacked by animals, and this is his coat, and it's filled with blood. And they tried to convince Yaakov that Yosef was dead. So the pasuk says, Yaakov refused to be comforted. Yaakov could not be comforted. And Rashi brings the medrash that the rule is that a person gets comforted after a while. If God forbid we suffer a bereavement, Hashem has created something in the world called time. And time takes away the acuteness of the pain. I don't mean that you ever forget. But the acute pain subsides a little bit so you can go on and live. For most people, that's how it works. Time is a great healer. But that's a gift of Hashem as well. And that gift only applies to people who are dead. Time heals my pain over the dead. But when somebody is alive... Now, Rashi does not mean that Yaakov actually knew that Yosef was alive, but the Neshama felt it. And therefore, psychologically, Yaakov could not be comforted, because you're not Mekabel Nechama on that which is alive. You're only Mekabel Nechama on that which is dead. This is what Rashi says. Again, it's from Medrash, actually. It's from Chazam. So says the Chazam Sefer, the Beis HaMikdash has been destroyed. Now we can add on 250 years to the Chazam Sefer, but almost 2,000 years ago. If the idea of redemption is dead, why should it still bother me? Time should heal my pain. If I'm still misabel, if I'm still crying, I'm still mourning, that means the Beis HaMikdash is still alive to me, and that's why I don't get comforted. Because if it's dead, I would be comforted. The same way that Yaakov could not be comforted because Yosef was alive, I cannot be comforted because the idea of the Beis HaMikdash is alive. Therefore, that itself can make me happy. Kol ha-misabel, in the very process of my mourning, I feel the joy of redemption. Because I then ask myself, why am I so sad? Because the Mikdash is alive. I get to feel a little bit of that joy. That's why on Tisha B'Av itself, it's very paradoxical. Tisha B'Av is such a sad thing, but there are certain rituals of Tisha B'Av that are only connected to happy days. We don't say Tachanun because it's kind of a yomtiv. That's very, very interesting. We certainly don't celebrate it as an open yomtiv, obviously. But we want to have in our consciousness that this is also a time of redemption, a time of rejuvenation. The old minhag of Yerushalayim is that women, I don't know how many people practice it, but the old Yerushalmis do, that Tisha B'Av after Mincha, you sweep your porch, you clean your merpeset in honor of the Mashiach that you believe will come very, very soon. And you do an actual hachana in that way. There was a ceremony that you actually do, a special cleaning up of the house, whatever it would be. And these minhagim are very deep and they're very profound because they remind us that from the avelus of our destruction, we could feel and be margish, a sense of the gula. And of course, another perspective is that of the Talmud Yerushalmi. The Talmud Yerushalmi tells us a very important thing. Kol Dor Shelo Nivne Beis HaMikdash B'Yamav Ki'il Nechrav B'Yamav. What does that mean? Any generation in which the Beis HaMikdash is not rebuilt is the same as the generation in which the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. Now that's very, very significant. Because we might have thought, okay, the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed 2,000 years ago because of different aveiros, but we don't have the extra zechus to get it back. But we're not guilty of those same aveiros. Chazal say no. If we wouldn't be guilty of the same chataim that caused the churban, it would be rebuilt. Meaning the reason the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed is not because it was destroyed, but every single minute it is getting re-destroyed. It is as if spiritually there is a fire going on right now. How could a person walk by? Now, the Chazon Ish used to say about electricity, it's very interesting. Now, the Chazon Ish's shita is, which was not the minhag of Yerushalayim, but more and more people are following it. B'nai Brak Psak, the Chazon Ish paskin that you're not allowed to use, even if you turn on your lights before Shabbos, since electric power is generated by Jewish workers. So the Chazon Ish's shita was, you're not allowed to even use that electricity because you're benefiting from Chilul Shabbos, and you have to have your own generators, right? That was the Chazon Ish's shita and the like. So, you know, the Chazon Ish discussed the halachas, pro and con, and there are different halachic issues. But at some point, the Chazon Ish said that if you truly care about Shabbos, forget about the technicalities. He gave an example. Imagine you're walking by the Beis HaMikdash, and it's burning fire. It's burning. And you take out your cigarette, and you light your cigarette by the fire of the Beis HaMikdash. Are you allowed to do that? Yeah, actually you are allowed to do that. Halachically, there would be no iser in your lighting your cigarette. Not the fire of the Mizbeach, but the fire of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. You're walking by the fire, light your cigarette. But how could a Jew, even if you had a heart of stone, how could you casually walk by and just look at the fire of the Beis HaMikdash? Or the like. Well, in many ways, the Beis HaMikdash is being destroyed in our eyes. And Chazal tell us the Aveira that caused the Churban was Sinas Chinam. And the Talmud Yerushalmi tells us if we didn't get it back, we must be guilty of that same Aveira. Sinas Chinam. There's no question. There's no question. I mean, it's not a question of me identifying the Chait. I mean, I could not identify the Chait. Chazal identified the chait that was going the churban of the Bayis Sheni, that was Sinas Chinam. And the Talmud Yerushalmi says, if you don't have the Beis HaMikdash, it is as if it is being destroyed for the same reason. So it would stand to reason, it seems, just by syllogism, putting those two Mamari Chazal together, that it is the sin of Sinas Chinam, above all, that is responsible for the Churban Beis HaMikdash. Now in truth, I don't know if I have to bring any proof for this, because we do see every single day how much Sinas Chinam exists. And Sinas Chinam is not only, you know, open hatred, but Sinah includes indifference, callousness, not caring, cliquishness. You know, some people belong, some people don't belong, some people are in, some people are out. The idea of the Nitziv writes in the Hakdama to Sefer Devarim that what was the Sinas Chinam of the Bayis Sheni? The Sinas Chinam of the Bayis Sheni was each person looked at another group and said, you're an Apikoros. Your ideas are wrong. It was what you might call a religious Sinas Chinam. Now, the Nitziv himself was criticized for that when he wrote it. You know, what can I tell you? They thought, oh, the Nitziv is being soft on whatever it was. But this is what the Nitziv says, one of the true great, great Gedolei Yisrael. So, something we have to work at. We have to work on in our own lives. Again, I probably say this thought every week in this sense, so forgive me for repeating it, but it's something that I think about quite a lot. And that is that a lot of the tension that exists between religious and secular would simply go away if a Torah community could appreciate even the Mesiris Nefesh of those who are not totally observant, to appreciate the sacrifices of soldiers, and by the way, there are many religious soldiers as well, but even the non-religious soldiers, as well as the religious, of course, to appreciate the police, the fire department, the infrastructure. And as Shlomo HaMelech says, water reflects the face you show it. You show a person kavod and dignity and respect, they will have kavod and dignity and respect for you. And if you argue, well, let them do it first. Why do I have to do it first? The answer is, a person who believes in Torah has to do it first. That's exactly right. Meaning to say, we have mitzvahs of Avas Yisrael, we have chiyuv, we have obligations. So we have to do it first, yeah. That's exactly right. But the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow is that by doing that, you will get from the other people as well a sense of respect, a sense of admiration, a sense of Kiddush Hashem. And that is a huge, huge way of healing the divisions that exist in society. Because, like anything else, you know, you kick a dog and the dog's going to bite you. Whatever. You call people Amalek, you call them Rishayim, you call them, no, they're going to behave like Amalek, they're going to behave like Rishayim. Because what's the use? You think I'm a Amalek? Okay, I'll show you what Amalek can do. But when we come to people with a different attitude, an attitude, not of even patronizing them, but an attitude of respect and appreciation, they changed their whole attitude. I remember, let's just give you maybe a trivial example. I was at a conference once, and Alan Dershowitz was one of the participants. And he was supposed to debate with a very prominent lawyer, Nat Lewin. Many of you might know Nat Lewin, a great, great lawyer. And I was gonna sit in the audience and, you know, sign, listen to a good debate. Nat Lewin couldn't make it, so they asked me to debate Dershowitz less. I absolutely did not want to do it. It was like a last minute debate about different issues. And, you know, Dershowitz grew up in a religious family, actually, but he left it for different reasons. And, I see, you know, when I came there, you know, he was going to debate and talk about how prejudiced, you know, Orthodox Jews were that don't understand. And even his body language, his arms were folded. First of all, he was offended at a little pipsqueak. I was much younger than I was going to debate him. You know. He thought he was going to get somebody important. And, you know, so the first thing I said was, you know, when I went to the law school where he teaches, and he didn't remember, you know, but the first day I was in school, 1976, he introduced himself to me. I was wearing a kippah. And he said, you know, I'm not that religious, but if I can ever help you out. So I mentioned that story, and all of a sudden you could see his arms like are unfolding, you know. And I said, you know, I really admire so much of what Professor Dershowitz says, and I said, you know, you make some very excellent points. And like by the end of that little like 5 minutes, like he was like a kitty cat, you know. He was really nice and gentle, non-aggressive, you know. And this is really a major key, and I wasn't faking it, because you try to identify within every person something that's positive and something that's good. Then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. People live up or live down to how they're perceived. The child that is perceived as stupid and bad will tend to be stupid and bad. and the child that is perceived as good and worthwhile will live up to that. And really, part of how we deal with Sinas Chiyum in a one-to-one is to try to connect to people on that particular level. One thing I'll tell you, that the one thing I've seen in all the great, great Gedolim, not that I knew so many, is this tremendous sense of seeing the chashivas of other people. And I'm talking about Jew or non-Jew, religious or non-religious. I'm talking about Rav Moshe Feinstein, I'm talking about Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Whoever they encountered always walked away feeling that they were respected, feeling that they were admired, feeling like a million bucks. I'll tell you a little story about a person who was really considered to be the great Gadol Hador, Rav Chaim Ozer Grodzinski. Rav Chaim Ozer Grodzinski in Vilna was the, really, he and the Chafetz Chaim were the Gedolei Hador. Rav Chaim Ozer was, of course, a genius in Torah, but it wasn't only in Torah. I mean, he managed, he died in 1940. He died of natural causes. But he was the one who managed to arrange through Vilna, all the yeshivas managed to get to Shanghai and then Japan, or Japan and then Shanghai. He arranged everything. And all of Klal Yisrael's needs in the most difficult times were on his head. Tremendous. In fact, he was so involved in Tzorchei Tzibur that they say that every Rosh Hashanah, he would make a promise he will learn Torah at least a half an hour a day. Now, I think he learned more than that, but he basically said he didn't even have a half an hour. This is how. My own Rosh Hashiva recalls as a bacher visiting Rav Chaim Ozer Grodzinski. And he describes the scene. Imagine a big apartment in Vilna, and there was a huge, huge table, like a dining room table, and it's like these people who play 30 chess games at once, and there were 40 people sitting around the table. One person had a shaylin halacha, another person had a tzedakah request, another person had an eruv problem and a mikvah problem, and he's learning and he's writing something at the same time. And each person like throws their thing, he answers, another person throws their thing, one person stops talking. My Rosh Hashiva said he saw this. One person stops talking because he figures Rav Chaim Ozer is not able to hear. He said, go on, I heard you were talking about this. And his wife is having a conversation, he interrupts, I don't know, you know, he comments with his wife, there are two phones in the house. Wow. This is already in like 1930. This is before the World War II is when Rosh Hashiva saw it. And Rav Chaim Ozer was handling all of these different things. Tremendous, a brilliant person and a committed person. And, you know, Vilna had many, many non-religious Jews. I mean, you think about Vilna like the Vilna Gun, but Vilna had plenty of non-religious. It was a big city, and there were plenty of Jews who were communists, who were socialists, who were Bundists, who were anti-religious. And they have so many stories. Rav Chaim Ozer once called up the president of the Jewish students at the University of Vilna, who was a Bundist, he was a communist. And he called him up and he said, you know, I know that a lot of you students are going to have to be in the university for Pesach. I want to give you money for matzah and wine and buy kosher meat, you know. And he said, you know, they would not go there for anything. But he made an effort to reach out. But the story that I want to tell you is this, that this is already much later. This is 1939, 1940, shortly before his death. So the Joint Distribution Committee, the joint from the United States, was sending food and money to Jews in occupied territories who were not yet deported in concentration camps. And there was a fellow from Cincinnati. He happened to be a physician, but he was a representative of the joint. His name was Dr. Samuel Schmidt, and he tells this story. Dr. Schmidt was a representative of the joint, and every week he would write a newspaper column for the Jewish newspaper in Cincinnati, saying about what's going on in Europe and the like, so people should know. And he was a Mechallel Shabbos. He was not a religious Jew at all. But he had to meet with Rav Chaim Ozer because Rav Chaim Ozer was in charge of distributing funds and collecting money. Not collecting money, but getting the money from the joint and distributing it to whoever needed it. So they're talking about where the money needs to go and the addresses and the paperwork and the bureaucracy. And in the middle of the conversation, Rav Chaim Ozer takes Dr. Schmidt's hand and he puts his hand on top and he says, Dr. Schmidt, you know, I've been calling you Dr. Schmidt. Do you mind if I call you Reb Shmuel? So Dr. Schmidt knew he was sitting with really the greatest rabbi in the world. And he started shaking and he said, you know, Reb is also a title of honor to some degree. Reb. He says, you know, Rebbe, I don't deserve Reb. I mean, you know, I don't keep Shabbos. I don't keep kosher. He says, I'm not really a good Jew. And Rav Chaim Moser said to him, I don't know what you mean you're not a good Jew. You risk your life to come to Europe to help Jews here. And you could have been comfortable in America and you're Moser Nefesh. Why do you say you're not a good Jew? You're a great Jew. And Dr. Schmidt started crying. And Ad Kedei Kach, that it was that encounter that made him a Shomer Shabbos. He says, the next day, he put on tefillin. He kept kosher. So Rav Chaim Moser was not involved in Jewish outreach per se. He was not even a good speaker, by the way, even at conventions. He didn't even give drushes. I mean, he didn't like to talk. He didn't like to do anything publicly other than paskin, all the shilas that needed to be paskin. But how did he change a person? He didn't change a person by proving to him the Torah comes from God or the 48th way, you know, although that has a place. I don't mean to disparage anything. But by showing that he believed in somebody, that he respected somebody, he saw the goodness in somebody, that person wanted to become a religious Jew. And that is really the key to everything. That is the key to how you can help a person discover Judaism. That is the key of how you eradicate, I'm giving all these formulas, how to eradicate sinasrina. This brings the geula. When I can look at another Jew, even if he's not a Shomer Shabbos, and say, you have goodness within you also. I believe in you. That is how we work with our children. That is how we work with our spouses. And it then becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Now, apropos of nothing, I got to tell you another Rav Chaim Moser story, although it's not connected at all, but it's very, very cute. Rav Chaim Moser was ill. He eventually died of cancer. And he used to spend the summer months, the month of Av, in a resort in Germany. Many Gedolim went there. In fact, we have many pictures of Gedolim in these resorts. Rav Shimon Shkuf, Rav Baruch Ber, Rav Chaim Moser. But one time Rav Chaim Moser was there only by himself. And he had to be there not just for Av, but for Elul, and even for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And there were like Jews who lived there, but they were not, you know, they're not that religious. It was like, you know, modern, and it wasn't what he was used to. It wasn't Vilna. And he's really very, very sad that he has to be away from Chaverim and away from Torah and away from Kehilas of Kedusha. And he's like in a hotel, you know, for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And he was very sad. He didn't know why did Hashem put him here. So one day he's walking before Rosh Hashanah and he sees a Jew who looks like he came from Lithuania. You know, familiar face. And he says, Shalom Aleichem, Reb Yid, it's so good to see you. What brings you here? So the Jew says, well, I'm here because my brother was a groundskeeper. My brother was one of the people who took care of the grounds. And my brother died, and he left a widow with three young children. And it's very, very hard for her to manage. And I, you know, I'm not married. So I've come here to marry my sister-in-law. Now, I don't know if you understand this. There's a mitzvah of yibum if a brother dies without children. But it is absolutely an iser d'oraisa to marry your brother's widow if there are children. It's a chi of kares. It's an erva. So Rav Chaim Moser says, you can't do that. You're not allowed to marry your brother's wife if she has children. So he says, you know, I don't know what you want from me. I don't, every rabbi come, you know, you tell me something. I don't know who you are. You tell me I can't do it. I mean, my sister-in-law has three children, and I have to help her. What do you want from me? So Rav Chaim Moser says, I'm not giving you a chumrah of the Ramah. I'm telling you this is a pasuk in Chumash. This is in the Chumash. There's no question about it. So the person says, you know, I can't change my plan because every rabbi tells me something. He says, I have to hear it from authoritative source. So Rav Chaim Moser says, how could I convince you? So the person that only knew one rabbi says, you know, I have to hear it from Rav Chaim Moser Brzezinski, and then I'll believe it. He heard the name, but he didn't see another person. So Rav Chaim Moser says, ah. He says, now I know why Hashem put me here. for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, that should be able to save this Jew from doing it. Again, apropos of nothing, but again, it's a very interesting story. A third story, again, we started with Chaim Moser, is some of you may remember Rav Gutzman, Zichron Olivrach. Rav Gutzman was a great, great, also phenomenally great person who became a Dayan of Vilna at a very young age. Rav Chaim Moser was already towards the end of his life. Rav Yisrael Gutzman, he's a Gutzman. He started the yeshiva in Rechavia, Netzach Yisrael. That was the first yeshiva in Rechavia. You know, Rechavia used to have a zoning rule. No yeshivas or shuls in Rechavia. The first settlers in the 1920s didn't want any religious people there. So Netzach Yisrael was like broken. That's why it's still a yeshiva that tries to be fairly friendly to some of the surrounding population. But Rav Gutzman became a dayan in Vilna at a very, very young age. Rav Chaim Moser was already in his 70s. Rav Gutzman was like 20. He became a dayan. So he used to ask Rav Chaim Moser shaylos, obviously, all the time. So one time Rav Chaim Moser would take a walk every day. And they were talking learning normally. But one day Rav Chaim Moser was looking at mushrooms and grasses and saying, you know, this mushroom you can eat, and this one is poisonous, and this grass is good, and this is not, and this can be done. And Rav Gutzman is wondering, why is he wasting my time here? I mean, who cares? Anyway, a few years later comes the Holocaust. Rav Gutzman and his family joined the partisans. And for 5 years, they were living off grasses and mushrooms. And he said, many of his fellow partisans actually died from poisoned mushrooms. He says, he knew what to eat. Because Rav Chaim Moser told him, it's like a Ruach HaKodesh. This is before the Holocaust. Rav Chaim Moser somehow, whatever it is, he had some vision that he should tell him about all of these things. Today? When? Who, Rav Gutzman or Rav Chaim Moser? This week. You know, this is a very funny thing. You know, this is like the fifth time this has happened to me. That just I start talking about somebody and someone tells me the earth says, it's this. Minashamayim, for sure, there's some message that to talk about the greatness of a person. But as I say, Rav Chaim Moser was a brilliant, brilliant genius. But what is even greater is this kindness and concern. He once said towards the end of his life that when he was young, he thought the most important thing he could do would be to write a sefer. Since when he got older, he saw that it was more important for him to help an almana. And he says, and that is how he lived his life. Okay, you all well, and again, we hope that there will not be a fast of the ninth of Av this year. May it be a time of sasim v'simcha. But if chas v'shalom, we do have to fast, may it be the last of the fast.